Let me tell you where this class is going. First of all, it's going slow. That's where it's going. This is a class on the survey of the New Testament. We haven't even opened our Bibles to the New Testament yet. But to me, there is a lot of material that is helpful for us to look at before we get to that, before we actually get to the book of Matthew. There's a lot of information that's helpful for us to know, background studies for us to know, so that we can put everything in its context. You know, sometimes if you don't look at something in its context, you don't have the full understanding of what was going on. When you read about a man in the Bible who went out and hanged himself, if that's all that you knew about that man, is that he went out and hanged himself, would you have the full picture of what was going on? Do you have a full understanding of everything that was happening? Nope. You'd just think, boy, what a guy, went out and hanged himself. But if you could put that in its context, now you have a deeper understanding. Every time we come to the Bible, we've got to put things in its context. And so even when we come to a large section of the Bible called the New Testament, what we want to do is to put it in its context, to put it in the setting what was going on then. And that's why we've spent these few weeks beginning at looking at the political setting. What was happening politically in Palestine and in the Roman Empire, so that when we open our Bibles to Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, when we open our Bibles to the New Testament, what's happening in the world? It's important for us to know that. We may not think it's important for us to know that, but it is very helpful for us to know that. What was happening socially? What was happening economically? That was some of what we looked at just briefly last week. What was happening in people's lives? What was going on with their relationships with each other? Now, what we want to do tonight, and I had thought that we might be able to make it to the book of Matthew tonight, and as I was coming back today from Fried Hardeman, I thought, that's never going to happen. We're never going to get to the book of Matthew tonight. So I thought what we would do is just park right here on this religious setting. I don't think there's any way we're going to cover all of these pages that are here, but I'm at least going to try to get you the blanks to fill in on these six or seven pages. What was happening religiously? Now, this may be the most important contextual setting that we talk about. Political, we talked about. Social, economic, all that we talked about. What's happening religiously? And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this first page. That's why I didn't put any blanks here, okay? But if you were to look at the Roman Empire as a whole, what was happening religiously in the Roman Empire? Well, Have you heard of Zeus? Well, you've heard of Zeus as the Greek god. Did you know that the Romans came along and they made some equivalents to some of those Greek gods of mythology? They made some equivalents to that, some Roman gods. And so partly in the Roman Empire, that's sort of the religion. What kind of religion is that? If you were to worship the god of the sky, wow, wouldn't that be fascinating? Worship the god of the sky. What's the god of the sky done for you today? What's the god of the sky going to do for you tomorrow? You don't have to worry about the god of the sun. That's a completely different god. You don't have to worry about the god of the moon. You're just worshiping the god of the sky. Could that be kind of empty? As far as a religion goes, could be kind of empty. That's where the Eastern religions came in, and they started to fill a void, because there were some mysterious things about the Eastern religions that gave people some personal involvement and personal satisfaction in their religion. Now, as this empire continued to grow, the Caesars became extremely powerful. And that did not go unnoticed. It did not go unnoticed to the Caesars that they were very powerful. Can power go to your head? You think it went to their head? It did not go unnoticed to these Caesars that they were the most powerful guys in all the world. And it did not go unnoticed to the people that these guys are powerful. And so over the course of time, some of the emperors started to demand that the people worship them. Now, it was not uniform with all of the emperors. They did not all demand that over the course of time. But as you get into the first century, there were some of those emperors that were like old King Nebuchadnezzar back in Daniel chapter 3, with that great image, and you're going to bow down to me, and you're going to bow down to my image. There were some of these emperors who thought they were all that. You're going to worship me. So what's happening religiously in Rome? It's a mixed bag. You've got them worshiping the God of the sky, the God of the stars, the God of the... You got all of these mythological. And then you've got these Eastern religions that are these feel-good kind of things. Then you got the emperor worship. That's kind of real. Because if you don't worship the emperor, can he do something to you? I mean, what can the God of the sky do if he gets upset with you? Get an umbrella out. He knows God of the sky is not happy with me today. But can the emperor do something serious? I mean, so the emperor can demand that you worship him. And then we have also in here the idea of the occultism that existed then. And that was the idea that the world is inhabited by spirits and demons that have an influence on everything that's happening on us. And so there were sorcerers, magicians, who supposedly had the ability to manipulate what the spirits and what the demons did. Can you think of any magicians? Can you think of any sorcerers supposedly in the New Testament who supposedly had these magical powers to control the spirits and the demons? This was a big deal back then. And they also believed in the spirits of the universe, not just the spirits within the globe and on the earth, but they believed in the spirits of the universe. And people do today too, don't they? It's been so long since I've read a newspaper, I couldn't tell you if for sure it's still there, but I think it probably is still there. Is the horoscope still in the newspaper? So you can open up the newspaper and you can read, here's what's going to happen to me today. How does the newspaper know what's going to happen to you today? Well, they just copied it from somewhere else. Newspaper doesn't know that. It's the stars, and that's not Hollywood stars. It's the stars that know. It's the spirits of the universe that know. And so they divided the night sky into 12 parts. And whatever part you were born under, whatever constellation, whatever god you were born under, that's the God who has power over your life. And so from the day you were born, your life is determined. The course of your life is determined by that God. Is that a hand up or are you scratching? Yes, sir. Were these religions new? Is that the question, or is the question, is this leading up to the grounding for the New Testament, for New Testament Christianity? Yes. It's both. Okay. What's the point of looking at these religions that existed in the Roman Empire? The point is that you have in this empire a mixed bag. You've got people who are on one page, on another page, on another page. Now, what you have, and what Brad alludes to when he's talking about the fullness of time, look on page 17 where I've tried to summarize some of these. We've dropped these in throughout these early pages, but what I've done on page 17 is to try to summarize and list all of these for you. One of the reasons we're spending time looking at the setting and the culture and the context, what's happening in the New Testament. It's because of what Galatians 4 and verse 4 says. It's a very interesting passage. We talked about this last week, where the Bible says when the fullness of, of the times. I don't think all translations have the definite article the before the word time. But when the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman. Jesus came when? He came when the fullness of the time had come. What does that mean? I know what a full glass of tea looks like. Okay? I know what I look like when I'm full. You know, what is the fullness of time? What is that talking about? How can time be half full, half empty? What is the fullness of the time talking about? It was the right... Who said that? It was the right time. It was the right time. Well, who determined that it was the right time for Jesus to come? God did. Was God just waiting? Was He just waiting for the stars to align? Was He just waiting for the planets to form in exactly the right position? Was He just waiting? Oh, okay, we're almost here. Okay, let's do it now. Or was God at work behind the scenes to bring all of this to the point that it would be just right? Do you think God knew what time it was? When you go back, even to passages like Genesis chapter 15 and verse 16, where He talked about the iniquity of the Amorites was not yet full. That's kind of interesting. I mean, iniquity, sin. I mean, if you sin, do you really want your sin to get full? I mean, let's not let our sin get full. Let's empty it out. But what was He talking about? That God knows what time it is. And when the time came, and this is off topic, but when the time came that the iniquity of the Amorites did grow to a full point, what happened to the Amorites? They were destroyed. They suffered the consequences of their sins. Did God know what time it was? Was He preparing all of this about? And that's what page 17 summarizes for us. And we've noted some of these as we've gone along here. Number seven and eight and nine, kind of the last three, are somewhat an answer to Brad's question. What does the religious setting have to do with the study of the New Testament? First of all, you have a religious tolerance throughout the Roman Empire. A religious tolerance that, okay, if you want to worship the God of the sky, go ahead. If you want to worship the emperor, if you want to worship these Eastern religions, if you want to believe in magic and sorcery, or if you're one of these philosophers, the last one that we had on page 11, if you're one of these philosophers that says, well, I'm not really into religion, but what I want to do is I want to take human wisdom and human experience and pair these together and allow that to be my guide in life, human wisdom and human experience. And in the Roman Empire, you could do that. Where was Judaism? Was Judaism allowed to exist in the Roman Empire? Yeah, sure. It's just another one of the religions. And so it's interesting that Rome has come to power, and Rome, to an extent, has allowed whatever peoples have come under its power and under its rule to sustain their religious beliefs, including the Jews. And so if you keep page 17 there and you go back to page 12, what we do is we say, okay, let's bring this in, not just talking about what's happening in the Roman Empire, what's happening in Palestine? And when we think of Palestine, when we think of the area where the Jews lived, here's where Judaism really thrived. But as you keep your finger back on page 17 there, were the Jews only living in Palestine? Is that the only place you're going to find Jewish population? No. In fact, the Jews had been spread out all over the place. Now, how did that happen? How had the Jews been spread? I mean, they're supposed to be in Palestine, right? That's their homeland. How did they get spread hither and yon? Okay. Persecution, perhaps. What happened when the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom became unfaithful to God? Did they suffer consequences? All right. They suffered the consequences, same way the Amorites did. They suffered the consequences of their sin, and they were destroyed and taken into captivity. What does that mean? All right, northern kingdom, Assyria comes in, conquers them, and takes many of them into Assyrian captivity. Well, you think all of those Jews moved back home when all of that was done? No. When the southern kingdom was overtaken by Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon and carried off into Babylonian captivity. How long were they in Babylonian captivity? 70 years. And at the decree of Cyrus in 536 B.C., when Cyrus said, the king of Persia said, now the Jews can go home. Did all the Jews go home? No, they didn't all go home. Why not? Because if I'm a second or third generation Jews living in the land of Babylon, what have I done? I've grown roots. I've established myself there. I don't have to go. So they didn't all come back home. There was a huge Jewish population down in Alexandria, Egypt. So here's the Jews spread out all over the Roman Empire. What does that have to do with the timing of the coming of Jesus? Is that going to be a benefit to the spread of Christianity? Sure it is. Absolutely. Why? Because of the last thing, and I think this is the number 9 on page 17. Because with this Jewish spread out, the Jewish dispersion, you have a Jewish preparation ready for the kingdom of God to come. Why? Because you have people who believe in the one true God. They don't believe in the God of the sky. They don't believe that the emperor is the God. They don't believe in this sorcery magic stuff. These are Jews who believe in the God of the Bible. These are Jews, and again, they are a variety of Jews, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, with a variety of belief systems within them. But by and large, they are a group of people who believe in God, who are devoted to that God, and who are anticipating the coming of the Messiah. The coming of the kingdom. And so when that message of the Messiah and the kingdom comes to them, they ought to be, and they weren't always, they ought to be ready to respond to it. And so as we talk about the fullness of the time, when we talk about religiously what's happening, God has prepared that this is the perfect time, the exact time for His Son to come. Now, when you go to page 12, what's the religious setting like there in Palestine? Much of the Jewish religion obviously centered around physical structures. Isn't it interesting how some things don't change? Is it possible that in our minds, a lot of Christianity, a lot of our personal religion centers around a structure? I'm not saying it's true for you, but is it true for some Christians that what makes them a Christian is I go to church, centers around a building? Isn't that interesting that sometimes human nature hasn't changed? But for the Jews, that was the case. Now, was that the case because that's what they had developed themselves, or had God developed this for them? Where did they come up with the idea for the temple? Was this something that God commanded them to do? You have on your handout that when we come to the New Testament, this is actually, if we're going to count them out, this is actually about the third temple. And we mentioned this, I think, last week. The third temple, at least the structure itself that the Jews had had. Solomon built the first temple. That temple was destroyed by the Babylonians when they came in and conquered the land. When Zerubbabel came back after the decree of Cyrus, when Zerubbabel came back from Babylonian captivity, his responsibility was to start rebuilding that temple. And he did with the help of Haggai and Zechariah, those two prophets. And that temple stood for a while. And then around 168 B.C., Antiochus Epiphanes came in and desecrated that temple. We talked last week about how he set up an idol to Zeus there near the temple, where he went in and he sacrificed a pig on the altar at the temple, just desecrated that temple. And it was in 165 B.C. that the Jews got the temple back, and Herod the Great is the one who's responsible for the rebuilding of that temple that we see in New Testament times. But that's Jewish life centered around the temple in Jerusalem. And we'll talk in just a couple minutes about their feast days. But there were three major feasts every year where the Jewish males were supposed to do what? Supposed to go to Jerusalem and supposed to gather there at the temple. So the temple was a major part of Jewish life. But the second thing that's on your list is not just the temple, we know about that, but it's the synagogue. What's a synagogue? If in your mind, what is a synagogue?
Place of worship.
Okay, place of worship. What did you say, Richard?
It's a temple branch office.
Okay? Now, in the Old Testament, we had the tabernacle, a tent, a temporary dwelling place for God. That was superseded, obviously, by the permanent structure of the temple. Where did the synagogues come into play? We do not know the exact origin of the synagogues. You don't read about synagogues in the Old Testament. If you were to pick up a concordance and look up the word synagogue, you will find zero occurrences of that in the Old Testament. It's not until you get to the New Testament you read about synagogues. All of a sudden, they're just on the scene. Okay, well, what are they? Where'd they come from? The best evidence indicates that somewhere in the time between Babylonian captivity and during this 400 silent years between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Jews started building these synagogues wherever there was a Jewish settlement. And perhaps they started it during the Babylonian captivity because could they get to the temple? I mean, the Jews were supposed to go to the temple three times a year. Could they do that while they're in Babylonian captivity? No, they couldn't do it. And even if they could, there'd be a problem. It wasn't the temple. So you got a problem here. You couldn't go there, and if you could, it wasn't there to begin with. So perhaps it was during that time that the Jews started to build and to use the synagogues as a branch office, as a place, because what did the Jews want? They wanted a place where they could gather. And actually, the synagogue, it provided a number of benefits. It provided some social benefits, obviously, as a place where they could gather. But you have on your handout that it served primarily as an education center. That's where the Jews did their teaching. Isn't it interesting, then, that Jesus would go to a synagogue, that Paul would go to a synagogue, and when they went to a synagogue, there was a Bible study taking place. And you read about some of these Bible studies, and isn't it interesting that the synagogues were spread all over the Roman Empire? When Paul went to certain cities, where did he go first? When he got to Thessalonica, where did he go first? To the synagogue. Why? Because that's where the Jewish people who believe in the one true God, who believe in the Scriptures, who believe in the prophecies about the coming Messiah, who would be the prime targets for the gospel of Christ, that's where they would be. Now, we don't have evidence that God commanded them to build synagogues, but did God use their synagogues for His purposes? Yeah, they're spread all over the place. And Paul is able to go into synagogues and to have the service, if you want to call it a synagogue service, to have the service turned over to him. Sirs, is there anything that you would like to say? Oh, yeah. How would you like to be a preacher and walk into a building and for the rabbi, for the leader to say, is there anything that you would like to add to this discussion? Oh, yes, sir. And so Paul was able, because of these synagogues, to have many opportunities to teach the gospel. Look at the bottom of page 12. Middle of page 12 talks about the major structures, the temple and the synagogue that were a part of Judaism. Sometime between the Old Testament and the New Testament, sometime in that 400 silent years, the Jews began to divide into various groups or into what are called various sects, S-E-C-T-S. And again, the exact origin of these, we don't have the exact origin of these. If you were to again get a concordance out and look up the word Pharisees, look up the word Sadducees, look up these, are you going to find them in the Old Testament? You won't find them in the Old Testament. Not till you get to the New Testament that these words are just dropped on you. And they're dropped in the old, they're dropped in the New Testament as if we should know who they are. And if we go back and do a little study, we can learn who they are to the best of what can be figured out historically. How much of this do we go into? There was a period of time between the Greek rule over Palestine and the Roman rule over Palestine, about 100 years, from about 167 BC to about 63 BC. And so there was some Jewish independence there, but underline the word some. But during that time period, the Jews begin to splinter into these groups because the Greek way of life and the Greek rule over the Jews had really started to impact their lives. And some of the Jews rebelled against the force and the rule and the lifestyle of the Greeks. Some of the Jews said, "This is not us. This is not the way we need to live. This is not how we're going to go about things." And they rebelled against it. Others of the Jews, you know, they didn't want to be the ones who were rocking the boat. They didn't want to be the ones who were viewed as, you know, the opposition. So when it came to the Greek rule and the Greek customs and the Greek way of life, they were a little bit more, well, tolerant. A little bit more accepting. Well, there you've got two polar opposites, don't you? Do we give in and mold ourselves into the Greek way of life, or do we say, no, this is not us? And so the Jews begin to split, as it were. And so on the bottom of page 12, you have those who are called the Hellenists. And if you do any reading and study in the New Testament, you're going to be reading and some historical documents about the Hellenists. These were Jews, but who were sympathetic to the Greek way of life. And they were okay with the Greek way of life. Then there's the Hasidim. They defended the Jewish law and tradition against the Greek ways. We are not going to give in to the Greek way of life. We're not going to follow along with this. And then we've talked about in here the Maccabees, led by Mattathias Maccabees, who was the father of the whole family there. They were the ones in about 167 BC, who led an actual revolt against the powers that were coming down upon them. Now, what does all of this have to do with us? This split between the Jews on, what's your next page number? Page 13? The split between the Jews is what created the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Zealots. Where did these people come from? They came from this period of time where the Jews were being pressed to accept the Greek way of life, and some of them were willing to do it and some of them were not. And obviously the two biggest groups that we know of are the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were the ones who were not willing to give in to that Greek way of life. They were the ones who were devoted to, at least in their minds, devoted wholly to the law of God, and we will not turn against it. Sadducees, on the other hand, they were the politicians of the Jews. They were the ones that were interested in making friends and having people to like them. They were the ones who were interested in having power. They were the aristocrats of the Jews. They're the ones who wanted the power and the prestige. Pharisees didn't care about that, but the Sadducees did. So if you compare on page 13, if you compare the difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, you see on letter C under the Pharisees, they were devoted entirely to the entirety of the Old Testament. What's interesting about that is you look down under the Sadducees, what letter is it? Letter B under the Sadducees, they followed only the Pentateuch. They weren't interested in the rest of the Old Testament. The Pharisees were interested in staying true, or at least in their minds, to the rest of the Old Testament. Sadducees were only interested in, to an extent, with the Pentateuch. If you go back up and look at letter C under the Pharisees, here's what they had done. They believed, it's interesting, they believed that at Mount Sinai, what did God give? Give me the right answer to this question. What did God give to the Jews at Mount Sinai? He gave them the law, right? What kind of law was it? What did God do with his own finger to give at least part of that law? He wrote it down. Now, what about the rest of the law? What about the rest? Did God get... Remember, those 10 sayings were not the only law that God gave at Mount Sinai. Is that true? You pick up and read the book of Leviticus. Does that have any laws in it? Yeah, that's the fun part. All right, that happens at Mount Sinai. So at Mount Sinai, the entirety of what we call the law of Moses was given at Mount Sinai. What kind of law was it? It was a written law. Part of it written by the finger of God. The rest of it written by the hand of Moses, inspired by God. But the Pharisees, and there were other Jews who believed this, the Pharisees believed that God also gave Moses an oral law. That he spoke some things to Moses that, well, Moses didn't write them down. But what Moses was responsible for was to share that oral law with the next generation. And then that next generation, what was their responsibility? To share that oral law with the next generation. So you have the written law, and then the Pharisees believed there was also an oral law. Have you all ever played a game where you sit down with a group of people? What is that game? It's got different names to it. I've heard it called gossip. Where you sit in a circle as it is with a group of people, and one person says something to the person sitting next to them, and then that person shares it with the next person, that person shares it. So this, whatever message you choose to start with, it's called telephone too. I've heard it called gossip because it really gets at the idea of what gossip is. All right, so you share a message. You know what this is, right? And you whisper it in everybody's ear, all going all the way around, and the last person in that chain says out loud, "Here's what I was told." Now, what always happens? How does the final message match up with the original message? You would hardly know that they were ever the same message. Right? Why? Because what happens? Well, we hear things, we interpret them, we give them a little, not intentional, twist, spin, what we put it into our own words, and all of a sudden, when everybody does that and it comes back around, it has no meaning at all. I wonder, if God gave an oral law, if he gave an oral law at Mount Sinai, and he said, "Okay, Moses, your responsibility is to pass it to them, and they're going to pass it to them, pass it." You think God ever played telephone? If God gave an oral law, do you think he might have an idea what would happen to that law? When you read about the Pharisees and their dealings with Jesus in the New Testament, and you read about their devotion to things like the washing of hands and the picking of grain on the Sabbath, and what had happened? What they had done is there was the law of Moses, but they had built up, they wanted to protect the law of Moses. They wanted to protect the entirety of the old law. And so they had built up their traditions around the law. Based upon the oral law and their traditions, they had built that hedge around the law so that nobody could ever get here and violate the law of God. They had this hedge out here. Well, wait a minute. What are we supposed to follow? We're supposed to follow the law, or are we supposed to follow what the Pharisees want us to? Well, Pharisees got it all mixed up in their heads. Well, isn't that what happens usually? If we don't stick to the standard and we decide we're going to follow some other loosey-goosey, it changes when everybody passes it down to somebody else's law, what's going to happen to us? We're going to be twisted in our thinking. We're going to be out of balance. And so in Matthew chapter 23, what did Jesus say about the Pharisees when he talked about they neglected the weightier matters of the law? What had they done? Oh, we're going to emphasize this and emphasize this. Jesus says, you don't know what you're doing. You've lost sight of reality. Go over to page 14 for just a second. Is this page 14? Yeah. 5 minutes? Seriously? Okay, well, we just got to do this quick. Page 14, number 6, are the scribes. What do you often read about in the New Testament together? The Pharisees and the scribes. Scribes were not actually a different sect out of the Jews. They were usually just a part of the Pharisees. They were just, and so usually they're together, though. And the scribes were the ones who had the responsibility for copying the law. If you copied the law, would you perhaps know it better than somebody else who had not spent their life copying it down? You should know it better than somebody else. And so they had given themselves to, and so they were renowned, or at least held up in people's minds, as lawyers, as individuals who were teachers of the law. And so you remember in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 28, where Jesus ended his sayings, and the people were astonished at his teachings, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Matthew 7, 28 and 29. What does that indicate to us? These people had been listening to the scribes teaching. Scribes were the experts. They were the ones who knew the law the best. And Jesus comes along and he teaches, and it shows these scribes don't know the law as well as the people might expect. The scribes were usually just a part of the Pharisees. Now, you have the Pharisees, you have the Sadducees, you have the Essenes, who we don't read about in the New Testament, but they kind of went to a far right extreme, even beyond the Pharisees, to the point that the Essenes went out. They said, we can't live right and do right in the city of Jerusalem. We got to go and live out in the country. And so they went and lived out in the country and kind of devoted themselves to meditation. And then there was the Zealots. The Zealots were a, as you might expect from their name, an extreme group. They were a group who was so angry with Rome and so against Roman rule that they were zealous to overthrow Rome and not have anything to do with Rome. They wanted freedom from Rome more than anything else. And so they fought against Rome. They didn't believe in paying their taxes. We're not going to devote ourselves. You can't be a good Jew and be devoted to the Roman rule. We're not going to pay taxes. We're not going to have anything to do with them. And we'll fight against them tooth and nail, everything that they want. It's interesting, isn't it, that one of Jesus' disciples was a zealot. Why would Jesus choose one of these hotheads to be one of his apostles? Well, why would he choose Judas? Why did he choose Peter? Why did he choose a tax collector? Because he chose normal people. He chose regular people to be his apostles. Obviously, you get down to page 14, you get down to the Sanhedrin. Obviously, that is not a sect of the Jews. I included it here because they were kind of the Supreme Court. They were the ones who were the Jewish court. When you read the word council in your New Testament, that's the Sanhedrin. That's the 70 men plus the high priest who were the Jewish high court at that time. They made the decisions. They made the judgments at that time. And it's interesting, the ones who made up that Sanhedrin, you see, are the Sadducees, individuals who did not even believe in the resurrection, were sitting on the Jewish high court. The scribes, who had their own interpretation of the law, and then the tribal heads from the various parts of the families. We've got 1 minute, and all I want to do is just let you look at pages 15 and 16 to see, obviously we don't have time to talk about it. When you get to the New Testament, we need to put ourselves into the Jewish calendar. Not the American calendar, the Jewish calendar. On top of page 15, you have kind of the outline of the Jewish calendar, at least their months, and they're listed on page 15. They are listed from in a religious order. They had a religious calendar and a civil calendar. That'd be confusing, wouldn't it? They had a religious calendar that started with the month of Nisan. not Nisan, what you drive, okay? It started with the month of Nisan. That was the start of their religious calendar. But their civil calendar started with the seventh month of Tishri. And so depending on, so when they started a new year, on Tishri the first was their new year, and on your calendars today, it's called Rosh Hashanah. That's the Jewish new year, civil new year, not their religious new year. When in the Old Testament they talked about the first month, the 10th day of the first month, the 14th day of the first month, that was the month of Nisan. That was the month in which you have the feast of Passover that's included. But read through, and do I have blanks on there? I don't remember if I put blanks. Here, there's your blanks. There's your blanks for those pages. Read through those pages and try to become familiar with the feast days, the holy days of the Jews, because those come into play and have a very important part in what takes place when we get in the New Testament. Okay, what are we going to do next week? We're getting into the book of Matthew next week. Read through that book over this next week. We'll get into that book, and we're going to have to combine books together to make it all the way through the New Testament. Thank you all for your good attention tonight.